First of all, a lot of scenarios of the future are, it seems like they're either utopian or they're dystopian. And it's interesting that a lot of polls right now show that people are generally concerned and even in some cases fearful about the future. How do you feel about people's views of the future right now? And do you feel that their fears and concerns are misplaced?
I think that people's views of the future, when things such as the economy or we're not at war, or in other words, when the social milieu, social climate at the time is optimistic and productive and people have jobs and it's fairly a rosy picture, they tend to look at the future based on that context. It's clouded by the present, so therefore the future then becomes much more, I think, optimistic. That's how people tend to view it. Over the past couple of years here, as we're unwinding from financial crisis, from certain wars and conflicts, and when leaders fail to, I think, address issues that people then become fearful about that are impending, meaning moving forward into the future, I think that tends to cloud people's notions, and they develop a pessimistic and justifiably so future concept. But in general, just, you know, biologically, part of how humans have evolved over the millennia is by forecasting, inevitably. It's part of our biology. You forecast to anticipate risks, whether it's about a potential harm coming to you by others or by weather. This is how we've survived, is by thinking ahead. I do think that it changes and can change almost moment to moment. I also think that people are not, let's say in the United States, and this is somewhat geographically dependent, in the United States we tend to be a very optimistic culture. We, you know, this is the new world, and we tend to be optimistic about what's coming next in general. Europe happens to have a much more dystopian, negative, a dire sense of what's coming, and always has. A very different kind of social and cultural milieu in Europe versus the United States, and that obviously influences how people think what's next.
How do you feel about the future? All things in balance, considering all of the positive and perhaps negative things that you see as trends that we're facing right now. How do you feel?
Well, as a professional futurist whose business is to advise my clients and to do good forecasts means that they're honest and they're accurate, as best as myself and my organization, the Institute for Global Futures, can predict. As I feel optimistic about the future. I recognize that there are significant challenges that we need to, as a civilization and as a nation, address, and those are not going to go away. Do I feel optimistic about our ability to be able to meet those challenges, whether they're jobs or addressing climate change or dealing with big global grand challenges that affect the U.S. as well, such as competitiveness and things such as economic debt? I think we have all the tools and all the capabilities and have demonstrated in the past in this nation our ability to meet large challenges effectively. So I have somewhat of an unfair advantage because, you know, we produce a lot of research and we analyze a lot of research and we advise the largest companies and governments in the world. So we get access to a lot of specialized information and intelligence about what's happening. And we have our own models and tools. So my basis for being optimistic is grounded in research and analysis, not just a Pollyannish sense of, oh, things are going to get better. Now, having said that, even though I'm optimistic, I'm not a believer that the future is written. I do, and I'm not a utopian or a dystopian. I believe that there are very serious challenges, economic, geopolitical, global, competitive challenges. But I'm a big believer also that, as I said earlier, our education capabilities, our science and technology capabilities, and our leadership capabilities as a nation can address those. I'm less optimistic when I look at the global challenges that are facing the U.S. and other nations, that the leaders on the planet today have the caliber of intelligence and capability and honesty to be able to signal a sense of, let's say, confidence that they understand the challenges and are moving on them with the right kind of policies. I think the corporate sector, in many regards, there's a lot more honesty and authenticity about dealing with challenges. But again, corporations don't necessarily, are not the arbiters of a lot of decisions and policies that global organizations or certainly governments must step up to. So there's a disconnect that does concern me very much between industry and governments in general. But overall, I think we have a leadership crisis on the planet that needs to get addressed over the next, I would say, 15 to 20 years, or there's going to be many more problems emerging, and I would turn much more negative.
So I would assume that one of those problems might be, this is a guess on my part, that global warming may be one of those issues where it might be that the challenge is perhaps so great, and there may be other factors involved why governments aren't acting, but it's beyond the scope of any individual government, and so there's a kind of deadlock that we find ourselves in.
So you're accurate. That is one issue, certainly, is climate change in general. But let me just say, and I point this out in my book, The Extreme Future, which thesis of the book is what you just indicated, the level of challenges that are facing leaders and all of us on the planet today and moving forward over the next 25 to 50 years defy our leaders' capacities to fully understand them and then to achieve a consensus of strategies to manage them effectively. And you can say that about climate change, you can say that about geopolitical conflict, you can say that about, you know, technologies, you can say that about a number of things, but certainly climate change, global warming, is something that affects everybody, and there is not a global consensus, and that is something that must get addressed, because the research, as a social scientist I can say, is overwhelming, yet the leadership that has been brought to bear is really just not there. And I say that as a global futurist, not somebody that's speaking as just an American.
Mm-hmm. Here's another challenge that a lot of Americans are talking about, especially lately. It's gas prices. They have been rising, and although they rise and fall, it seems as though many people feel the trend is toward higher prices long term. We have a lot of fuel-saving technologies that people are working on. But there's this paradigm that especially I think we in the United States live in, and that is the idea that we own automobiles and we want to have our car, or in some cases multiple cars. In a future where prices continue to rise, and despite, let's say, the fuel-saving technologies that we work on, batteries and other kinds of advances that we might make, is there a stronger place for other kind of transportation options like mass transportation in our future?
Well, I think without a doubt, the future will be mediated by innovations that are driven by alternative fuels. And the automobile is the largest polluter on the planet. But keep in mind, the key technology, and again, as a global futurist, my focus for the last 30 years really has been on technologies, science and technology that has been able to bring, you know, key catalysts to create productive change on the planet, whether it's about, you know, food or climate or certainly business or education. But let's talk about automobiles. You know, if the internet and computer revolution, having started only really 30, 40 years ago, not even that, if you had tracked parallel to that the evolution of automobiles, people don't realize today, but the internal combustion, you know, engine is not that far from the original Model T. You know, we haven't had that level of effectiveness, and, you know, Moore's Law for automobiles hasn't happened. So having said that, you know, what the future is going to look like is going to be in many regards mediated by the private enterprise. You know, it's going to be by supply and demand, meaning that you're going to see a lot more hybrids that are not just electric, you know, gas hybrids, but you're going to see biofuel electrics. You're going to see certainly a new generation of even battery technologies that will emerge, and it will be driven by the marketplace. I mean, all of the forecasters in the automobile industry predicted that hybrids would never catch on. It would be just a little trend that would never. Nobody forecasted, except, you know, you had a little company called Toyota that decided to change the dynamic here. So I think the tolerance for consumers of paying more is going to be offset by new innovations that will offer people. Now, when it comes to mass transit, we know how to do electric and hybrid technology. We know how to do that right for mass transit. I mean, there was in the L.A. area, Los Angeles, there was a red card. There mass transit in many parts of the world, whether bullet trains in China and in Japan, or whether the mass transit systems in European capitals, even those that have been in the U.S., I mean, the BART system in the Bay Area is fantastic. At the end of the day, the move towards mass transportation that is part of a new energy grid in America has to be part of our future. And I can tell you that our energy grid in the United States is based on a 19th century model, and it's unsustainable. And by the way, everybody knows that. So you're absolutely right. But again, the marketplace, just as with the high adoption of hybrids, the next generation of hybrids and electrics and new, even ethanol will come back, and other biofuels will come back, and eventually fuel cells. I mean, there was an interesting conversation with the president of General Motors, and he asked his management team, how is it possible that a little company in California called Tesla was able to, you know, create a fuel-based, battery-based car, and we couldn't do that. We didn't get that to the market first. So it has to do with the mindset and the paradigms of our leaders, coming back to that central theme. Mm-hmm. If you can't envision a future, then somebody else that maybe has that vision should step in and provide that. That's the new level of leadership we're going to have, I think, that's going to envision more productive and more innovative solutions for a world that's looking for them.
Speaking to this issue of rising fuel prices and fossil fuels in general, another aspect of this, so much of our food production is tied to that. The fertilizers that we use that create tremendous yields that make it possible for us to feed billions of people are the result of fossil fuels. What do you see in the future as the ability of us as a planet to feed a growing population, even as perhaps fossil fuels supplies reduce in the future?
There are a couple of trends that relate to that. Certainly the largest one is population. So, you know, as a global futurist, I'm in dialogue with a group of agri-companies and governments. I was recently with the cabinet in Malaysia. We were discussing this very issue. They have 17,000 islands and 30 different kinds of languages that are spoken. The ability to be able to just address the logistics and food demands of 280 people in Malaysia, that alone. When you're looking at the planet, I do have deep concerns because the rising, let's say, on one end of the spectrum, you've got rising affluence and a new middle class emerging, particularly out of Asia, India, China alone. The demands of that middle class for energy, and particularly how it will impact food, just take protein alone. There is not enough grain and protein capacity to keep pace with population growth. So the key drag on, let's say, global GDP is going to be the high cost of energy. Energy related to food means that food costs will dramatically go up. And again, nobody's really looking at the carrying capacity, which is a kind of a technical term that talks about, you know, do we have the ability to feed 8.5 to 9 billion people, which is what we will have certainly by as early as 2040, certainly by 2050, based on the high end of the UN forecasts in terms of population growth. So this is a big vexing problem that all governments are looking at now. And again, nobody is really looking at it together, other than some bodies like the United Nations, to be able to say, well, if we're going to have this level, you're going to add another 2 billion people on the planet. How are we going to feed them? Water is a critical issue that's going to be part of this as well. So, again, there's not really a global agenda to address increasing the carrying capacity of the planet in general, speaking globally now, to address the next couple of billion people, when today there's 1 billion people that are living in poverty who haven't seen a clean glass of water. There's another 1 billion people who are under, are malnourished and undernourished. We're not doing such a good job around this today. So to add another 1 billion, or in this case, we're 7 billion today, you're talking about potentially another 2 billion, given the fragility of fresh water, given the fragility of the carrying capacity issues related to our ability to feed, let alone house, the next couple of billion people. I would say these are, along with climate change, some of the largest problems that we have to start dealing with. And unfortunately, we really have not had a context to be able to reach consensus that there's global ownership of this problem. So this is part of the challenges the next couple of decades. Quite frankly, the next really 5 to 10 years, we have to, as a world, deal with.
I'm reminded of a blog post you wrote about Steve Jobs and about his leadership capabilities. And I'm not going to be so simplistic as to suggest there needs to be one leader that arises to work on these things. But I guess what I'm saying is that that is a common theme among the problems we're talking about, is that there is a lack of leadership. And sometimes it does take a few individuals to actually, really get people to focus their attention on these. And we seem to lack that.
Well, that's right. And the problem is so vast. But at the end of the day, if we haven't yet seen a Steve Jobs, and I used to work with Steve. I was on the original Apple Macintosh team that brought out that computer, and I was a futurist, kind of looking at all of these big global changes. And of course, working at Apple gave me a chance to be able to roll up my sleeves and do something about it, if you will. We thought we were changing the world by producing these personal computers that people could then start to deal with some of these issues, and I'm happy to say that worked out for many instances. But we don't yet have the level of leadership of a Steve Jobs, I believe, that we do need, that has the bold solutions to move forward a global consensus to deal with these big grand challenges. And there's other ones too. I mean, there's poverty, there's wars, there's other kinds of issues that we're going to need to deal with. But I don't want to overwhelm people with a number of challenges. That's my day. That's what my world is all about. I think the takeaway for a listener certainly is, look, at least we know what's on the landscape of challenges that are facing us. One. Two, I'm a great believer that there's massive science and technology innovations, but what's missing, and certainly everybody can play a role in this, is not just the solutions that can galvanize action and a global consensus, but the bold courage that leaders need to show, whether they're in their little town or whether they're leading a nation or they're leading a company. There's lots of room for bold, courageous leaders to show up yet and to be able to change the dynamic to help us, succeed at meeting the challenges of the 21st century.
Dr. Canton, thank you so much for spending some time talking with us, and good luck tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.